Welcome to Circulation on the Run, your weekly podcast summary and backstage pass to the journal and its editors. I'm Dr. Carolyn Lam, associate editor from the National Heart Center and Duke National University of Singapore.
And I'm Greg Hunley, associate editor, director of the Pauley Heart Center at VCU Health in Richmond, Virginia. Well, Carolyn, this week we're going to examine outcomes in patients that have undergone transcatheter aortic valve replacement, or TAVR. And I can't wait to get to the results from the EXTEND study. But before we do that, how about we grab a cup of coffee and start in with some of the papers? And maybe I'll go first this time. My paper involves a validated model for sudden cardiac death risk prediction in pediatric hypertrophic cardiomyopathy. And the corresponding author is Dr. Seema Mittal from the Hospital for Sick Children. Well, Carolyn, in this study, the objective was to develop and validate a sudden cardiac death risk prediction model in pediatric hypertrophic cardiomyopathy to guide sudden cardiac death prevention strategies. So to address this, the authors performed an international multi-center observational cohort analysis. Phenotype positive patients with isolated hypertrophic cardiomyopathy who were under the age of 18 years at diagnosis were eligible. The primary outcome variable was the time from diagnosis to a composite of sudden cardiac death events at 5 years of follow-up. That included sudden cardiac death, resuscitated sudden cardiac arrest, and aborted sudden cardiac death, that is, an appropriate shock following primary prevention ICD.
Nice. So what did they find?
Well, overall, 572 patients met the eligibility criteria with 2,855 patient years of follow-up. The 5-year cumulative proportion of sudden cardiac death events was 9%. Risk predictors included age at diagnosis, documented non-sustained ventricular tachycardia, unexplained syncope, septal diameter Z-scores, LV posterior wall diameter Z-scores, LA diameter Z-scores, peak LV outflow tract gradients, and the presence of a pathogenic variant. Now, unlike adults, LV outflow tract gradient had an inverse association, and family history of sudden cardiac death had no association with sudden cardiac death. The combination of clinical and genetic data were developed to predict 5-year freedom from sudden cardiac death. So in conclusion, the author's study provides a validated sudden cardiac death risk prediction model with over 70% prediction accuracy and incorporates risk factors that are unique to pediatric hypertrophic cardiomyopathy. And these results therefore raise the possibility that an individualized risk prediction model has the potential to improve the application of clinical practice guidelines and shared decision making for these children prior to an ICD insertion.
Very interesting. Well, Greg, have you ever wondered what are the temporal trends in the burden of comorbidities and risk of mortality among patients with heart failure with preserved ejection fraction, or HFpEF, and heart failure with reduced ejection fraction, or HFrEF? Well, the next paper comes from Dr. Kogi and colleagues from University of North Carolina and North Carolina State University, who performed an analysis of the community surveillance component of the atherosclerosis risk in communities, or ARIC study. And they found a significant increase in the burden of comorbidities among hospitalized patients with HFpEF as well as HFrEF across both sexes. Higher number of comorbidities was associated with higher risk of 1-year mortality, with a stronger association noted among patients with HFpEF compared to HFrEF. The 1-year mortality risk associated with increasing comorbidity burden also increased over time.
Interesting, Carolyn. So more comorbidities in HFpEF versus HFrEF. So how do we use this clinically?
This study demonstrated a shift from ischemic etiology heart failure to multi-morbidity heart failure over time, particularly among patients with HFpEF. And this really highlights the importance of a holistic approach in targeting multi-morbidity burden and guiding the management of patients with heart failure.
Very interesting. Well, Carolyn, my next paper comes from Professor Matthias Nerendorf from Mass General Hospital and involves the relationship between bone marrow endothelial cells and myelopoiesis in those with diabetes. And Carolyn, this study investigated the role of bone marrow endothelial cells in diabetic regulation of inflammatory myeloid cell production. The authors utilized three types of mice with diabetes, including a streptozocin model, a high-fat diet model, and a genetic induction using leptin receptor deficient mice. They assayed leukocytes, hematopoietic stem cell and progenitor cells, and endothelial cells in the bone marrow with flow cytometry and expression profiling.
Ah, and what did they find?
Well, in diabetes, they observed enhanced proliferation of hematopoietic stem cells, leading to augmented circulating myeloid cell numbers. Analysis of bone marrow niche cells revealed that endothelial cells in diabetic mice expressed less CXCL12, a retention factor promoting hematopoietic stem and progenitor cell quiescence. Transcriptome-wide analysis of bone marrow endothelial cells demonstrated enrichment of genes involved in epithelial growth factor receptor signaling in mice with diet-induced diabetes. So in summary, Carolyn, in diabetes, bone marrow endothelial cells participate in the dysregulation of bone marrow hematopoiesis. Specifically, diabetes reduces endothelial production of CXCL12, a quiescence-promoting niche factor that reduces stem cell proliferation. The authors also describe a previously unknown counter-regulatory pathway in which protective endothelial EGFR signaling curbs hematopoietic stem cell and progenitor cell proliferation, as well as myeloid cell production.
Wow. Thanks for explaining all of that, Greg. For this next paper, we're going to switch tracks a little. This comes from Dr. Dracos and colleagues from University of Utah in Salt Lake City. And they noted that significant improvements in myocardial structure and function have been reported in some advanced heart failure patients. And this is, they're going to call responders. And the responders improved the myocardial structure and function following left ventricular assist device induced mechanical unloading. This therapeutic strategy may alter myocardial energy metabolism in a manner that reverses the deleterious metabolic adaptations of the failing heart. And so Dr. Dracos and colleagues hypothesize that the accumulated glycolytic intermediates are channeled into cardioprotective and repair pathways, which may mediate myocardial recovery in these responders. To test this hypothesis, they prospectively obtain paired left ventricular apical myocardial tissue from non-failing donor hearts, as well as responders and non-responders at left ventricular assist device implant and at transplantation. They conducted protein expression and metabolite profiling and evaluated mitochondrial structure using electron microscopy.
Interesting. So what did they find, Carolyn?
The recovering heart appears to direct glycolytic metabolites into pentose phosphate pathway and one carbon metabolism, which could contribute to cardioprotection by generating NADPH to enhance biosynthesis and by reducing oxidative stress. So this new information could redirect future translational investigations to efforts to identify novel therapeutic targets for myocardial recovery in patients with chronic heart failure. Well, Greg, can I tell you a little bit more about what else is in this issue? There's a letter by Dr. Wang regarding the article, A Novel Role of Cyclic Nucleotide Phosphodiesterase 10A in Pathological Cardiac Remodeling and Dysfunction. And there's also a response by Dr. Yen. In cardiovascular case series, there's a paper by Dr. Meschelina on the nosology spectrum of the bicuspid aortic valve condition, the complex presentation of valvuloaortopathy. That's so interesting. There's a research letter by Dr. Gaudino on the response of cardiac surgery units to COVID-19, an internationally based quantitative survey, as well as another research letter by Dr. Salem on cardiovascular toxicities associated with hydroxychloroquine and azithromycin, an analysis of the World Health Organization Pharmacovigilance Database. There is a perspective piece by Dr. Jacobs entitled "The Temporary Emergency Guidance to STEMI Systems of Care During the COVID-19 Pandemic, AHA Missions Lifeline." In cardiology news, Tracy Hampton reviews three papers. One, video-based AI for beat-to-beat assessment of cardiac function in Nature 2020. Two, dynamic transcriptional responses to injury of regenerative and non-regenerative cardiomyocytes revealed by single nucleus RNA sequencing, and that is in Developmental Cell 2020. And three, ATP and voltage-dependent electrometabolic signaling regulates blood flow in the heart, the Proceedings of the National Academy of Science 2020.
Very nice. Well, I've got an in-depth review from Dr. Ben Zhou regarding the heart regeneration by endogenous stem cells and cardiomyocyte proliferation, controversy, fallacy, and progress. And then there are three on my mind pieces. The first is from Dr. Rashmi Shah regarding machine learning and artificial intelligence. Do we need more data or do we need the right data? The next one is from Sharon Reimhold, and it discusses the importance of gathering historical information on risk factors when seeing patients with or suspected of COVID-19. And then finally, Dr. Pratiti Kazani discusses ethical challenges in cardiology during the COVID-19 pandemic. Well, Carolyn, what a great review. How about we proceed to that feature discussion?
Let's go.
Well, listeners, we are now turning to our feature discussion. And this week we have Dr. Robert Yeh, also Bobby Yeh from Beth Israel Hospital, and our own associate editor, Dr. Brendan Everett from Brigham and Women's Hospital. Welcome, gentlemen. And Bobby, let's start with you. Can you tell us a little bit about some of the background related to your study? And then what hypothesis were you trying to address?
The study that we performed is the sub-study of what we're calling the EXTEND study, which is an NIH-funded group of investigations meant to really examine what the value is of real-world data and how it can augment clinical trial evaluations of medical devices and therapies. And we know that randomized clinical trials remain the gold standard for therapeutic evaluation, but they are expensive, difficult to do, and sometimes impractical. Real-world data is cheaper. It's potentially more efficient to do observational research studies. And in fact, the 21st Century Cures Act explicitly asks, among other things, that the FDA explore the use of real-world data for regulatory evaluations. And so people have problems with real-world data, of course. They have their own inherent challenges, which are subject really to confounding. And so what we thought about is, well, there's probably this middle ground that we and others have proposed, which is, can't real-world data somehow supplement or augment randomized clinical evaluations? And in particular, in our question, can real-world data be the provider of outcomes in place of adjudicated clinical trial outcomes? And what we did is we took two large pivotal randomized clinical trials of transcatheter aortic valve replacement, namely the CORE valve high-risk and intermediate-risk trials, otherwise the intermediate-risk trials known as the SIRTAVI trial. And we found those patients in those trials and then linked them with real-world data from administrative claims databases in Medicare. And so our hypothesis was that had the trial been evaluated in terms of outcomes by the Medicare claims instead of the clinical trial adjudicated outcomes, you know, our main question was, would we have had the same findings within those trials? Would the primary hypothesis of those trials still have been met with this sort of alternative clinical trial endpoint ascertainment strategy?
So in your study design, how did you accomplish the comparisons? And then you've told us a lot about the study population. Was this everyone from those two studies, or was this a subgroup of them? Maybe just expand on that a little bit.
Good question. So this is a US-based comparison. So we have claims for US patients. And most patients in these trials were in the United States, but the CoreValve trial and the Certavi trial, so we took all of those patients and then tried to find those patients who we could also find in Medicare claims. Now, it turns out that, you know, in order to qualify for Medicare, you have to be over 65 years of age under most circumstances. And so it's limited to really those patients over age 65 who we could then search for in Medicare. And then within Medicare, there's two types of insurance, fee-for-service and Medicare Advantage, sort of managed care. And what we can only find are those patients who are in Medicare fee-for-service, which represents somewhere between two-thirds and three-quarters of patients aged greater than 65 or older. So it is a subgroup of patients in these two large pivotal randomized trials. We've compared those who could not be linked versus those who could. By and large, apart from some of the age differences, which are just inherent in looking at Medicare, there are really not that many differences between those two groups.
So, Bobby, what did you find?
We found those patients. So now we have, you know, this situation where we have patients in trials, and we can look at them from two lenses, the same group of patients. One lens is through the clinical trial lens, and the second is through the lens of real-world data, those exact same patients. And we found that whether or not we ascertained their outcomes via claims or with clinical trial adjudication, essentially the primary hypotheses were identical, that in both scenarios, the transcatheter aortic valve was non-inferior to the traditional surgical aortic valve replacement, that the effect sizes in the hazard ratios, the confidence intervals, they were roughly the same. In fact, for the primary endpoint of the high-risk pivotal study, which was all-cause mortality, it was identical. It turns out that Medicare claims and what we call the denominator file very accurately identifies exactly when a patient dies. It does so equally well compared to sort of rigorous clinical trial adjudication. For Certavi, the primary endpoint was combined death or stroke. In that case, stroke is reasonably accurate. There were a lot of deaths that also drove that combined endpoint. And the net result was that really very similar, both effect sizes and primary, you know, p-values for those comparisons.
Now, how about secondary analyses?
I think the secondary analysis, that's where you had some variability. So there are some types of outcomes in this device-specific trial that are procedure-oriented. So pacemakers are a concern. Aortic valve reintervention is a concern. And those endpoints in billing claims, turns out, are quite accurate. And you can sort of understand why. I think providers and institutions, when they do a service that requires insertion of a new device, they want to get paid for those devices and they do that billing accurately. But there are other claims which I think are a little bit more subjective, diagnoses that are more subjective, those like bleeding or cardiogenic shock. Those things actually started to look different. And in fact, in some cases, started to give you different sort of inferences if you use the clinical trial data versus the real world data. And so if I were to sort of summarize it, I would say that mortality looked absolutely pristine, identical between the two groups, that some diagnoses, particularly procedural ones, looked quite good, sufficient, I think, for an accurate estimation of the treatment effect size, as well as the magnitude of the risk. But then some endpoints, I think the softer, more subjective endpoints, slightly different.
Thank you so much, Bobby. Now we're going to turn to our associate editor, Dr. Brendan Everett, who has helped work this article through the entire editorial process and is also an expert epidemiologist. So, Brendan, we have randomized trial data versus real-world data. How do you interpret these results in the context of how we're conducting studies, both now and then how we will conduct them in the future?
If you think of observational research and clinical research on a spectrum, with truly just observational studies on one end where you're trying to look at an exposure and an outcome and adjusting for potential confounders, to tightly controlled randomized trials on the other, Bobby's group has managed to sort of create a hybrid, which I think gives us some opportunity to not have to be either on one end or the other of the spectrum. And what I mean by that is that there are a couple key features of trials that are retained in the approach that Bobby used and his group used. He mentioned those, but I want to emphasize them. So I think the key thing is that there's a randomization step. And from the perspective of an epidemiologist, that's key because it balances between the people who get your therapy, in this case, a TAVR, and don't get the new therapy, confounders that you can measure and confounders that you can't measure, the unmeasured confounders. So it allows some balance between the two treatment groups so that you can be sure, at least at baseline, that they're similar groups. And what you're measuring after that point is the effect of the intervention. The key piece that Bobby replaced is the classical sort of trial ascertained endpoints where investigators are asked if their patient had one of these outcomes, such as a stroke or a death, and then they're adjudicated independently. And as he pointed out, I think there are many of those outcomes, at least in this particular application, are really well collected by billing data. And in fact, some might argue that in some cases, they're actually better collected. There's a higher sensitivity, if a somewhat lower specificity for the events of interest. I think the key question, and you touched on this, Greg, is what about the outcomes that maybe are not collected quite as well by billing data? And in particular, remember that any clinical trial is looking at both the efficacy of a novel treatment as well as its safety. And so you ultimately, at the end of the trial, want to be able to compare efficacy with safety to make a decision, in this case from the FDA, a regulatory decision about whether to approve the device or the drug. So the question becomes, what safety events are you worried about and how reliably are you going to be able to collect them with claims data? And in this case, I think Bobby mentioned that the bleeding data maybe was not quite as good as some of the other safety concerns that are common in TAVR. And so I think when you look to apply this approach, which I think is ingenious, to a different research question, you have to ask whether or not the endpoints, the efficacy endpoints, and the safety endpoints that you're collecting will be done in a valid and consistent and sensitive way with claims data as compared with the traditional trial ascertainment process. In this case, I think they were, but that's not always the case. And we can all think of examples where you might run into some trouble depending upon what your endpoints are.
Well, gentlemen, this has been really an informative study to present and talk about in this feature discussion. I want to ask you both just briefly, in a minute or so, what do you see as the next step forward in research in this particular area? Maybe Bobby, you first, and then we'll follow with Brendan.
I think that there are a couple different areas that really need to be pushed forward. One, and Brendan alluded to this, is because these studies are really domain specific, this validation does not tell us that all claims can be used to answer all questions. That in this particular question, it worked, but in others, it might not. So more validation work in different fields, different randomized trials need to be done. We're doing some of those, but they need to be done throughout so we can really get a better sense on what are the types of questions that are best answered by this type of linkage approach. And the second that is more sort of operational, we were limited to Medicare claims data. So for questions for patients who are younger than 65, this approach just doesn't work. Whereas a place like Sweden can do a large national registry like they did in the TASTE randomized clinical trial and do this for their entire country. So we do need to develop better systems that have comprehensive real-world data collection. Maybe those involve more consolidated electronic health system, health record data that are available in big integrated health systems, for example. But a better system needs to be developed that can answer questions among more than just Medicare fee-for-service patients.
Very good. And Brendan?
Well, I think it's a really promising approach to trying to lower the cost of clinical trials and to do valid research on the effect of some treatments as compared to others. From my standpoint, we have to be careful that we don't try and shortcut the process too much. In particular, I think the randomization step, at least for novel treatments, is of fundamental importance. And of course, to do that, you have to collect a population that is then willing to be randomized to option A or B. And so there's a lot of upfront work that is not eliminated by looking solely at the outcomes, using this technique to look at the outcomes. There's a lot of upfront work to collect the patients and then randomize them. I think also it's important, as we saw recently, that the quality and validity of the database be ascertained and be well established, both with the investigators and the providers of the database. And we can see that sometimes if you're not careful, you can come up with outcomes that are not correct because of the example, of course, I'm alluding to is the two papers in Lancet and the New England Journal that had to be retracted that were large database studies as well. So the quality of the underlying data remains paramount. That, of course, is where a lot of the elbow grease comes in. It's not just in the ascertainment of the events, but a lot of the stuff that leads up to counting the events at the end of the study.
Well, listeners, this has been just a superb discussion. On behalf of Carolyn and myself, we wish you another great week and look forward to catching you on the run next week. Take care. This program is copyright the American Heart Association 2020.